Okay, we have one last presentation. Before I introduce our speaker, I'd like to call your attention to a poster that will be presented in our area this evening on wood burning stoves in Darfur. Hugh Berman Slipper and Mike Clifford, are you here by any chance? They will be presenting a poster this evening on improving combustion conditions using CFD, computational fluid dynamic analysis, in wood burning stoves, and that's this evening. Okay, our last speaker, Don Petcher, is a physicist. He's from Covenant College in Lookout Mountain, Georgia, in the U.S. And he and his co-author Tim Morris have recently published a book, Science and Grace, a book on the theology of science. So our last talk in the area of philosophy of science, Don is mere science, taking the demarcation problem seriously. Welcome, Don.
Let's start by saying you might want to hear my talk on philosophy of science follows session on technology, but what I hope is that I have a technological audience of mostly scientists because I've been trying my ideas out. So
need your microphone.
How many are scientists? There you go. How many of you have heard of demarcation?
Mike?
It's here. Okay. How many have heard of the demarcation problem? So, it's more than 50% or 50%. In a less, perhaps, eclectic group of scientists who are not also focused on, say, Christianity, it would be a smaller percentage, and that's part of what I'm going to say. What is the demarcation problem? Why is the demarcation problem? Why is there a demarcation problem? Why we should be concerned with the demarcation problem of scientists and attitudes towards what is science and your science way forward? This is the outline of the talk. These are some ideas that I have been generating a few years ago, but actually we're just getting back to them in order to form a team for a second to work. And so I hope that feedback continues so we can make a good thing. First, what is the demarcation problem? Here's a quote. This is actually just let me read the slides. I think we'll go right about it. The history of philosophy of science in the 20th century is largely one is searching for a definition of science, first in method, they call it the hypothetical inductive way to see method, then perhaps in terms of objects of focus of science or within the bounds of science as social activity. But no sharp line can be drawn between science and non-science as the conclusion of all this philosophical research. But here's the quote from a paper by Larry Loudon in 1983. It's called The Demise of the Demarcation Problem. He says, it's probably fair to say that there is no demarcation line between science and non-science, or between science and pseudoscience, which would win assent from the majority of philosophers. This also, in disguise, is a kind of science-religion problem, which is why I also bring it up in this kind of thing. So why is there a demarcation problem? This, I probably have to use slides in this section. My point is really just to give you a kind of a quick overview of what the philosophers have been thinking over the century. I don't expect you to understand the details, and I won't go a little bit through that. But by the end, at least you'll see a clear idea of what we're talking about. Many summary accounts or apologies of philosophy of science in the 20th century outline the history of progression thinking on matters. And I've given you one by Del Ratch, who often comes to these meetings. He's a patent college professor. It's a good name. The main focus early in the century was an attempt to pin down what defines science, and therefore what leads to objective universal truth, kind of the modernist quote, was the received method, which I've already mentioned, and it was closely associated with logical positivism. But philosophers of science began to find internal problems with the method. They find that you can't theorize without creative leaps. We as scientists probably all know that. You can't really verify a theory, something underdetermined. Perhaps you could falsify a hypothesis, suggests, but falsification depends on believing other theories. And so you can't really falsify in the end either in a strict way. So Thomas Kuhn then came out with his famous book in 1962, Structures of Scientific Revolution, which raised other issues. suggesting perhaps theories are not objective, they're always within a social paradigm. Most philosophers don't go as far as Hume. In fact, Hume spent a number of years backtracking his own position. All had to reckon with Hume's view. Since then, philosophy of science has recognized the weakness of the project to strictly define science. And logical positivism is often said to have died with Carnap in 1969. Fred Suppe edited a volume of the Nicola conference about that time, which portrays this theme. Later attempts to describe science incorporate these in terms of research programs, rather than I want to give you just briefly what Loudon's paper says here. So this is just the part which he called metaphilosophical interlude, three criteria he said are needed for demarcation. The first two are here, and why is there a demarcation? The third one I reserve for the next point. He said you need conditions of adequacy for what makes science, and you also need conditions that are necessary or sufficient or both. That was an open question, so he wants to argue about that. So what about the conditions for adequacy? The quest for the latter-day demarcation criterion involves an attempt to render explicit those shared but largely implicit sorting mechanisms whereby most of us can agree to paradigmatic cases of the scientific and the non-scientific. That's a quote from the paper. You see what he's trying to do is he's trying to look at science and draw out what would be your necessary conditions. But he says, a condition that is only necessary does not tell us that something, e.g. Physics, is definitely a science. So if you've only got necessary conditions, you can't see what's in the box of science. A condition that's only sufficient does not tell us when something, for example, astrology, is not a science. And so you would seem to need both necessary and sufficient conditions, but then you generate an argument that suggests that that's impossible to actually do across the board. Now, the next point is probably more important to us. Why should we be concerned with the demarcation problem as scientists and as Christians? Loudon's third point speaks, what actions or judgments are implied by the label scientific? You can see some postmodern power plays creeping in here. The demarcation criteria are typically used as reçus de guerre in a polemical battle between rival camps. Indeed, many of those most closely associated with the demarcation issue have evidently had hidden and sometimes not so hidden agendas of various sorts. And some of you might think of the American cultural setting where we have all kinds of cultural wars and things. But the value-loaded character of the term science and its cognates in our culture should make us realize that the labeling of a certain activity as scientific or unscientific has social and political ramifications which go well beyond the taxonomic task of swearing beliefs in the two kinds. So Loudon is telling us that science has another role to play other than just purely neutral, effective truth. And so everyone knows that if you say that's unscientific, it's really a pejorative term. The evident epistemic heterogeneity of the activities and beliefs customarily regarded as scientific should alert us to the probable futility of seeking an epistemic version of demarcation criteria for historians. So his conclusion is, if we would stand up and be counted on the side of reason, we ought to drop the terms like pseudoscience and unscientific from our vocabulary. They are just hollow phrases which do only the loaded work for. And I want to emphasize that many, if not almost all, philosophers of science tend to agree with this, although there are programs to sort of understand what's going on in science. His conclusion continues, insofar as our concern is to protect ourselves and our fellows from the cardinal sin of believing what we wish or so rather than what there is substantial evidence for, and surely that is what most of forms of quackery come down to, then our focus should be squarely on the empirical and conceptual credentials for claims about the world. The quote scientific status of these claims is altogether irrelevant. Just the facts is basically irrelevant. No, I think some of these residue we have. But, nevertheless, in the culture, there are all kinds of things. I've got two culture wars going on right now. There might be a third, But one is the creation of machine intelligent design, especially in the United States. There's also another one, it's the modernism, postmodernism. Some of you are familiar with the Sokol affair, where he wrote a mock paper and then exposed it as a fake that was published in one of the sociological journals. There are also court cases that are decided on the term of science, what is science, what is not, which we know it's on the recent in Kansas. And also, there's another looming culture war going on with physicists now, as to whether superstring theory ought to be counted as science, because they're getting all the theoretical physics from it. But funding decisions are a very real issue in defining what is science and what is not. So you make up your own things. Now I'm just developing this stuff, because I want to just touch on some attitudes that the scientists have. If there is a demarcation problem, apparently many scientists, as I saw that many of you, don't know about it or buy into it or don't care. That's okay if they don't care, because as long as they don't assume demarcation and just go about the business, that's fine. If they use it for political reasons and so on, I believe that. For example, everyone who has ever taken a course in biology has read through the introductory section of what science is, how do you take a course in biology? You probably saw something like this. Other areas of scholarship share with science the practice of making observations and asking questions. Scientists are distinguished by what they do through their observations and how they answer the questions. Data is subject to appropriate statistical analysis, are critical in the testing of hypotheses. Scientific explanations for natural processes are objective and reliable because the hypotheses proposed must be testable and must have the potential of being rejected by direct observational experiments. Scientists clearly describe the methods they have used and test hypotheses so that other scientists can make their observations and experiments. Well, that's an attempt to be a synopsis of what is science. Many philosophers have examined many such definitions that have been falling wanting because they couldn't really pin down that something is or is not a science. Scientists who act eloquent about what science is, and this means in popular level books that scientists write, these are not quite, they're not going to fly across the world or something like that as well. They often attempt to choose a few items as non-negotiables, which actually serve as a de facto definition within their context. And that's kind of propagated. One thing is repeatability, well, that's good, but it doesn't apply to lots of things that you all in this room call science. Another thing is methodological naturalism, which some philosophers have tried to use as an important aspect of science that may be a necessary condition, even if not sufficient. But all are subject to the problem that the demarcation problem that I'm setting to. So let me just look quickly at the idea of methodological naturalism. Now, some people have written papers on this that you may know about, but I'm just bringing up a few points. What could it mean? Just think of what the terms mean. Well, it at least means that methods of science assume that we're studying the natural world. That's very obvious. One thing you could say that means is that science is only good at studying regularities. Well, okay, that seems reasonable, but it doesn't help you much in determining what science is or are you doing science, and sometimes there might not be regularities in what you're studying and you can't study one. So it doesn't really help us in a concrete situation. It might mean also that we must approach all problems of science with the assumption that the solution is naturalistic. Well, this kind of leaks over into a metaphysical thing, but it also isn't very useful. It precludes any other explanation. So it suffers that fallibility issue that it could be a simply incorrect assumption. This is something that Alpine will also be able to this paper on the subject. But why do we need methodological naturalism if it has these kinds of underlying problems? Either it's meant to really function as a kind of demarcation criterion, some people tend to use it that way, to exclude some cases, perhaps, it's one way of arguing against intelligent design, for example. But it doesn't quite work. It doesn't quite do the work for us. Or it's really saying something like science is only good at studying regularities, as I said before, and that's by assumption pretty correct. except we also have to include things like catastrophe theory, probability theory, chaos theory, so things that don't look quite as well. Or even quantum theory that is commonly used. But that's pretty inaccurate, so it doesn't really help us much. I mentioned I've looked at the issue in a paper about methodological inference, and I would just like to mention two kinds of science that he describes in his discussion. One of them he calls Duhemian science. Duhem was a physicist at the beginning of the 20th century who wanted to do metaphysics-free science. But if you really try to do that, it becomes a fairly limited science. It's only what's absolutely demonstrable, and that we'll all get in the room and say, yeah, we all agree, that's sort of the metaphysics-free science. Limited maybe to physics, chemistry, and some areas of biology. Proposes that we should consider what he calls Augustinian science. I'm not quite sure why he uses that term. The idea is to bring everything you know into what we do, including metaphysical assumptions, religious convictions, etc., and see where it takes you. And then at the end of the day, we'll all get together and see where things pan out. So it doesn't matter where it comes from if it gives you insight or motivation into your doing of science. It's the result that you contribute to cultural science in your house. So that's sort of my synopsis of methodological naturalism as it plays out in science. Now here's one example of a type of science. Stephen Jay Gould and many others have resurrected the two magisterian view, that is that science and religion are completely separate realms. But the problem is that this is really a Kantian reduction. It goes back to Kant's assertion that religion is basically ethics, so the ethical realm. It doesn't pertain to metaphysics, and therefore you can separate the two. But this is a problem because obviously religion is not able to be boxed like that. All right, now I want to give a few illustrations. My wife is the artist now. These are some trees. This is where the science of religion comes into play in the sense that when you separate them as two books, Book of Nature and Book of Scripture, we've heard that several times here, you can try to relate those in different ways. And this is sort of the modernist attitude. We're going to try to put them together. Here is a Gould's model. They don't have anything to do with each other, separate. Another way you could, I just came back. I thought I had another one in there. Maybe they're mine. Oh, we'll see if we can back, because I might have a more view. But perhaps we could have anticipated the problem earlier on if what Richard Feynman says is correct. Richard Feynman was a Nobel laureate in physics, and a very lively character, and he's just happy with his studies. He says he doesn't like philosophy, but he hides in philosophy. Mm-hmm. Right? What is science? He says, of course you all must know if you teach it. That's all you do. That's common sense. What can I say? If you don't know, every teacher's edition of every textbook gives a complete discussion of the subject. There's some kind of distorted distillation and watered down and mixed up words of Francis Bacon from some centuries ago. This is like the biology text I read earlier. Words which then were supposed to be the deep philosophy of science, but one of the greatest experimental scientists of the time, who was really doing something, William Harvey, said that what Bacon said science was the science that a Lord Chancellor would do. He spoke of making observations, but omitted the vital factor of judgment about what to observe and what to pay attention to. So scientists in the lab really had already known this kind of stuff. Feynman's way of defining science is basically, this is one thing he says about it. We've learned from experience that the truth will out. Other experimenters will repeat your experiment and find out whether you were wrong or right. Nature's phenomena will agree or they'll disagree with your theory. And although you may gain some temporary fame as a scientist, you will not gain a good reputation as a scientist if you haven't tried to be very careful in this kind of work. And it's this type of integrity, this kind of care, not to fool yourself, that is missing to a large extent in much of research in pseudoscience. So basically, science is what we learn not to fool ourselves. Notice the mention of the truth will out, or nature will have its way, and the integrity in not fooling ourselves. That's a whole cultural climate that we teach each other as we pass it down. The point is Feynman's integrity principle. The first principle is that you must not fool yourself. This is the quote as well. and you are the easiest person fooled. So you have to be very careful about that. After you've not fooled yourself, it's easy not to fool other scientists. You just have to be honest in a conventional way after that. Okay, so here come other models, other possible relation of the, you could say the science tree sort of overshadows the religion tree and it's got to sort of inform the religion tree. Or you can try to have a dialogue and intermingle them and that sort of thing. But what I'd like to move to is a different way of looking at things. And this is trying to define science seems to be a dead end, yet we all practice in the scientific cultural community. Using science as a trump in an argument seems more a powerful and helpful move. Let's, for practical purposes, agree that science cannot be sharply defined. The philosophers can keep sharp, but let's agree that it can't be, because that would be a safer assumption. If we can't define science, questions that remain are, what keeps science on track? Why does science work? What accounts for people of many backgrounds working together in cultural science and still making progress? How do we exclude those crackpots? That's the first question on anybody's mind when I give this talk. To address why science works so well, let's ask two questions. What is common among all scientists, and what is not common? This is sort of a mere science idea. It would not be long if you thought of mere Christianity as a sort of similar idea about Christianity. What is common? Well, we have the common constraints of creation. I do use the word creation. Which we sometimes refer to as laws of nature. We have a common set of confessional commitments, which I have to explain. The first one's pretty obvious. And we have a common social culture of induction friendship. And I think anybody who practices science on a high level knows that you couldn't have got there without those mentors that taught you and you worked with them. You couldn't just go out and read the papers abstracted by yourself. So that's a very important part. But what we may not have in common is a definition, well, we don't have one of those. And we may not have in common religious or metaphysical commitments, but that seems not to be important in the production of science. So here's common constraints of nature and the induction apprentice process in order to learn a trade are pretty clear to most scientists. In the second category, confessional commitments, what I mean here is the sorts of things we all are committed to. And we don't really, I don't need to pin them down, we all know they exist, but I'll give you some ideas. We expect to find regularities. If we're studying science, we expect that. We look for them. The integrity principle not to fool ourselves. Our senses and equipment accurately report nature's response. We can trust our logic. We're open to correction. These are kinds of things that scientists live with, and we know that we have lots of them in common. So rather than science being related to religion as two separate magisteria, science is rather like a huge river of activity into which all the different Augustinian sciences or cultural streams flow, constrained by the constraints of nature and the other commonalities that keep things on track, and there's no hard and fast certainty. And like I said, Augustinian science doesn't cover most of the rich activity of science. Now here's another quote, one more quote from Richard Feynman. We find that the statements of science are not what is true and what is not true. That's the modernist Enlightenment idea. But statements of what is known to different degrees of certainty. It's very much more likely that so-and-so is true than that it's not true, or such-and-such is almost certain, but there's still a little bit of doubt. Or at the other extreme, well, we really don't know. Every one of the concepts of science is on a scale graduated somewhere between, but at neither end of absolute falsity or absolute truth. And I think, as scientists, we probably resonate with that as well. So here's a different worldview tributaries going down to the riverbed of where the constraints are, and then out the other end on different interpretations about what the constraints, what we found mean, and that's where the arguments are. And so the common confession and the social and cultural also help to keep that riverbed. Now here's just getting right to the end, an example that I just uncovered a couple weeks ago in the World Magazine, which is a very conservative evangelical news magazine. They were interviewing Michael Behe, and World asked, many Christians will object to your defense of common descent, but we say, when two lineages share what appears to be an arbitrary genetic accident, the case for common descent becomes compelling. Why do you think the existence of similar broken genes in the genomes of humans and chimps proves their common descent? Now, we keep being sensitive to the audience because many of the readers of this magazine may be younger creations. He says, I should first emphasize that on the question of common descent, I wear against my scientists. Okay, I wouldn't tell him to say that part, but... So, if a person has strong theological reasons to question descent, then he may weigh the evidence differently than I do. The issue is weighing the evidence. Here's the way I see it, and then he goes on to tell about the genetic markers and inheritance and why he thinks there's a common ancestor. But I thought that was a nice case where somebody actually did something like kind of suggesting. This is, I think, what I'm saying. What would neuroscience change? Well, first of all, we can no longer use science as a trump card in early days. And second, when disagreements arise, we would have to get down to the nitty-gritty of why we disagree. Why each party believes or disbelieves claims. And so the worldview commitments will come out, and they should come out. And that would help understand that our religious commitments, or whether they play a role, or somebody who's an atheist or some other view, whether it plays a role. We recognize that focused on the evidence, the more controversial a claim probably means that the evidence is not as universally compelling as less controversial claim. That's the enemy to rich cultural science. And what about Grackpots? Well, nothing really changes there. How do we keep them out now? Obviously, you kind of don't. They never learned to be inducted into the club, and it's kind of obvious who they are, and so it just goes on the way it does. So neuroscience is a kind of humility science, science. But a science that forces us to sort of reveal our underlying commitments that are making us choose the different probability decisions. And I think for Christians, if we would be able to talk that way first together among ourselves, and secondly, talk that way to non-Christians, our dialogue would be much richer, much more civil.
Okay, we have time for some questions.
Yes.
Thank you. That was really, really clarifying. Almost as good as when I first read coding, what I've been doing for the last few years. Really, things don't work. The one thing I would question, however, is your use of crackpots. They should be in there too.
Well, they are.
Your river and your tributaries.
There is a river.
Sir?
There is a river, but they don't get.
But crackpots are great. We need them. So.
Sure. I agree with you there. I agree 100%.
They let the culture sort them out.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I mean.
You did mention, obviously evidence, but reproducible evidence. This is perhaps, I talk as a chemist, you call it repeatable evidence.
Right.
Isn't that an essential part of true hard science?
You do talk as a chemist.
Any theory, I don't worry about it, but any extension beyond that is sort of vaguely scientific. But
most of science that way, evolutionary biology, for example, is not reproducible. Even in our own field of physics or cosmology, we do take lots and lots of data and bring all the evidence together, but we can't do any experiments in cosmology.
The data is reaffirmable, if not. The data is reaffirmable.
Right, but if you get in discussions with different sorts of scientists in all across the board and you try to follow this, and they tell you, I experienced this once when we were in Oxford with the Paul, with the Christians, most of us, and some would, the biologists would try to tell us why we believe this or why we believe that, and as a physicist, I said, well, gee, that doesn't seem very compelling to me. I'd like to see the data, and how do you fit in, you know, and the other physicists began to realize, well, that's the way it is, whereas the biologists had a different criteria for what they accepted and how they viewed it, and I think we'd have to have quite a dialogue to really pin down the differences there. Repeatability was actually at the heart of some of it, because it had to do with evolution and biology and so on. And I'm not questioning that per se, except that there are different criteria. It
seems like there's a tension between Flanagan's idea of bringing all of your theological and
philosophical commitments to science, which may have been historically important in the origins of modern science. And the, on the other hand, the view that science is a public activity, that it's, you know, it's done by Christians and Hindus and atheists and everybody, and we expect to come out with the same results.
Yeah, I don't see that as a tension in the sense that you don't wear it on your sleeve as you go into the lab and you say, I'm making this assumption and I'm going with it. You met some of the creation scientists or something like that. Try to do that. But the point is that we do bring everything we do into the lab with us. We don't separate ourselves out when we go into the lab. And so the cultural science is just that combination of the many multi streams that are coming into it. And it still thrives. And when you talk to someone else in your cultural science, you don't always tell them everything that you thought when you were talking about your physicians. But you compare and see what they are willing to accept, and that becomes the common cultural science. Even though you may have different interpretations of what was going on about it when you get down under the surface. So, you know, for example, I did quark theory for years, and then one of my colleagues, I used to talk to him at lunch, and, you know, sometimes he said, well, I don't even know any of that stuff exists. It's the anti-realist position. And yet we're working on the same papers, you know, so it's quite a cultural mix.
I think we have time for one more question. The audience questions. I'll ask the last question. If I understand correctly, it sounds as though the demarcation problem is important, at least in part, because of the statement that falling something unscientific is pejorative.
Yeah.
It seems to me that in the last 50 years, perhaps 20 years, that we, that the world has become a little more tolerant of the idea that something may be true that isn't true in an unscientific sense. So that there are multiple...
you're thinking of a real question, Mark. Is that true for you, not for me?
Not necessarily, that revelation... could be a source of. So I'm wondering if it wouldn't be more helpful to simply define science a little more vividly, but acknowledge that there are other sources of.
I guess the conclusion of philosophers is that we can't do that. So if somebody came along and said, here's how we can define more rigorously, the choices are sort of there. Newtonian science is one of them. If everything has to be repeatable, everything has to be demonstrable to everyone. That could be a criterion, but it would limit a lot of the science to do.
So science is the only one that's normal.
There is another question.
Okay, one more question.
In your slightly more open view of what is science, how would you protect education, science education of, say, school kids from, for example, things that most scientists don't see as science and theory, like intelligent design, or astrology in India, which is sometimes taught as science to school kids. What would your answer to that be?
Well,
we can't say that's not science.
Actually, this is a very difficult question for me because I'm committed to write a chapter in the book that we're working on now on that very subject. And I haven't worked it out yet, but I think it's possible. You see, the problem that we're facing in America, and you may be facing it in other countries as well, is that we are moving into this pluralistic world of postmodernism, postmodernity, I should say, where we recognize that there are all these different perspectives. And I think we as scientists, especially the cultural science, we would recognize that many of them are valid. But we have to solve that problem in order to solve this problem. Now, if I were naive, I would go tell the schools to have a more open dialogue about why they believe things. But what I find is actually most of our school teachers are not educated to a high enough level in order to be able to discuss the nuances of it. So it gets out of hand very quickly, and so it's not very productive. So that's why I don't know how to solve that problem.
Thank you for attending our session.